Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. For those of you who don't get to my website regularly, I want you to know I have a new section up on mass shootings that has three or four of my latest reports and blogs. One's only been posted there, and others are from the more formal sites that I blog on. And they're full of information. One of the things that I'm really proud of is that shortly after the tragic shooting in Connecticut, there was a kind of an injection of truth serum into some of the talking heads on TV. And in particular, Sanjay Gupta, the much-praised CNN guru on medicine, neurosurgeon, was invited to be Surgeon General, but turned it down because he's doing so many other wonderful things, gives a lengthy description of how we have to take into consideration psychiatric drugs as a cause of shootings like Connecticut, and that he was really waiting for this data to come forth. Now, I think after that burst of truth serum from the horror of Connecticut, he shut up, and I've got some others there, too, that that came forth on Fox News. So we get it from the left and more from the right, too. And then not a word afterward. But I've captured it in film and video with the help of my wife and my assistant. So go to my website to the mass shootings and check out some of these articles with their marvelous links. Today, my guest is Dr. Frank McNamara. He's a psychologist, licensed psychologist. He works in an interesting place that I have a little familiarity at. Spent 4 years myself at Harvard, undergrad, and a year in the psychiatric training program, which, by the way, was arrogant, narrow-minded, and limited in its viewpoint, which is what you get at the top. And he's been 17 years now in the practice of psychotherapy in Boston and Cambridge. I got to ask him when he comes on, and I think he's listening now, whether he's signed up for our resource center on empathictherapy.org, because people are getting referrals off our resource center. He's teaches a class in counseling and psychology in the graduate program at Cambridge College on the role of, listen to this, psychiatric drugs and psychotherapy. So I look forward to a really interesting conversation with a gentleman who just makes me glad that I get to meet a lot of new and really good people by being out in the news, so to speak. Dr. Frank McNamara, psychologist. Are you there, sir?
I am. Hi, Peter. It's great to be here.
Oh, I'm really glad to have you on. Listen, start out and tell us just a little bit about yourself and what you do or anything you, any way you want to start.
Uh-huh. Well, I have to make a slight correction to what you said. I've been actually working as a counselor and psychologist at Harvard for the past 17 years, but I've been in the field for much longer. I've actually... it was about 33 years ago that I started off, believe it or not, as a volunteer in a psychiatric hospital I'm sure you're familiar with, McLean Hospital.
It's the best of the best, which makes it the worst of the worst.
Well, I experienced it firsthand, and it was quite interesting because I started off as a volunteer, and this was, probably 1979, and there were psychiatric residents in this small house where I volunteered who were essentially walking archives of psychiatric treatment history. There were people who had lobotomies and all these other kinds of treatments that they used to do in the past. And it was my introduction to the world of psychiatry, and it was interesting because at that point, of course, people were all beginning to take the heavy-duty psychotropic medications, the antipsychotics, and this was my introduction. And so after I volunteered for a while, they offered me a job, and then I worked there for a while, and then I went to graduate school, and I worked in many places over the years until I got to Harvard 17 years ago and found myself in an office that didn't really subscribe to the medical model so much. We work with people more along developmental lines. We do some study counseling. We do a fair amount of study counseling. We help people with practical skills. We also do sort of regular counseling around emotional and psychological things, but it's kind of a nice office because we can meet students wherever they're at. You know, if they have academic concerns, then we can talk to them about academic concerns. But then the conversation might drift into, you know, life concerns. And it's a great office, and sort of some people have described it. There was a student recently who was writing in the Crimson, the Harvard newspaper here, who called it a gem at Harvard. And, you know, to some degree, I have to agree. I think it's a great office because it doesn't really use a medical model. It meets students where they're at. We have conversations with students. We help them with practical skills. We have groups and so on. On the other hand, in my private practice, which I've been doing for all these years, and also in the system overall, what I've encountered more and more, of course, between 1979 and today, is the skyrocketing rate of prescription drugs and psychiatric meds being dispensed. And I've grown increasingly alarmed at it, and more I find in my private practice, for instance, that people come in to see me and they, you know, they've been on medications for a year, 2 years, 10 years, and at this point in time their PC continues to prescribe for them, and there's no thought really about evaluating the medications in their lives and whether they're needed or what kind of impact it's having on them. They've just sort of woven this into their everyday life, and it's caused me to be increasingly concerned because I've seen a lot of the, you know, the downside. I've seen the dark side of medications over the years, and I've been increasingly concerned about that, which is what led me to offer a course at Cambridge College, which is for graduate students who are entering the field of counseling or therapy. And this course, as you mentioned, it's on the role of psychiatric drugs and medication. And in my mind, this is sort of a gaping hole in people's and counselors' education. And as you write in your book, and I have to say that you've been an incredible influence over the years, and I think I've read all of your books, most if not all of your books by now, and you know, going back to the 90s when I first encountered toxic psychiatry, and thank God for your voice.
Thank you.
And I feel like the information that you're disseminating in your books has to reach those people, it has to reach everyone, but, you know, especially those people who are working with people who are seeking psychiatric counseling or psychological counseling, because medication is so ubiquitous, you know, and there's a tendency for people working in the field to just sort of accept that they do a certain piece of the work with people, and the medications are overseen by others. And I think that's a really unfortunate mistake, for all the reasons that you could articulate better than I could even. You know, and I actually point them to your book where you challenge people to develop a new model of treatment that's you know, doesn't put the prescribing doctor at the top, but instead empowers the patient and also empowers the people who are working directly with the patients to consider what's best for them, you know, and to make decisions on their own and not just accept the prescription of an authority. So the course is very powerful.
Let me stop there for a minute. First of all, thank you. The book, The Clarity, that you're referring to is Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, which is my latest book, and I subtitle it A Guide for Prescribers, Therapists, Patients, and Their Families. And that's wonderful that you're reading it and using it. It's intended exactly for you, the psychologist who's a therapist, as well as for the other folks. But I think in my mind I had a lot of emphasis on therapists getting the courage and developing the knowledge, which the book tries to provide, of the dangers of drugs and talking with patients honestly about it, and above all else, not just ordering patients to comply with their medication,
exactly,
which is the way that the training goes. Before getting on with your course, I had a couple of questions which I want to hear more about, just going back a little bit.
Yeah.
As a former editor on the Harvard Crimson, I respect their giving, calling you guys a gem, because we never gave out accolades to anybody at the university too easily.
Well, I should say it wasn't somebody on staff. It was actually a student writing in, because people were talking about the mental health services, not my office, but the separate mental health services, and there were a lot of complaints. And people, this one person wrote in and said, well, you know, have you heard of this office? And he's the one who called it a gem.
So this is very interesting and very, very important to understand psychiatry and to understand where you're coming from. Harvard has its own psychiatrically oriented mental health clinic, right? And that's not what you're a part of.
Right.
So you're
Well, my office a number of years ago was integrated into that system, but we're still separate. So administratively, we've been integrated into the whole mental health system, but our office is really separate, and our mission is separate.
So do you have any psychiatrists breathing down your neck, so do you have to worry, and you can answer this obliquely or indirectly or not at all, but do you have to worry about a psychiatrist looking over your shoulder and saying, this guy's got to have drugs?
Well, we don't have any psychiatrist in our office, but you know, of course, the whole system is overseen by psychiatrists, and we certainly interact with psychiatrists in other parts of the systems because there are students who seek services over there as well as here, and you know,
what building are you in? Education building? Where are you? I think it's important to sort of, because all these issues of power and authority are so important in the field, and to have someone working in the university but not necessarily right under the thumb of psychiatry is very, very important.
Well, you know, ultimately we have to answer to to the psychiatrist at the top, and so you know, it's definitely a model where the authority, you know, ultimately rests with them, and you know, we certainly interact with psychiatrists regularly. The question is, how do we interact? And I think that's, you know, to some degree a personal decision, depending on the particular counselor or therapist who's interacting with them. I find myself oftentimes, you know, challenging them or raising questions and so on, and trying to have a dialogue. But, you know, this sort of reflects my feeling of confidence about engaging that conversation. And, you know, as I was mentioning, this course I think is so important because I see so many of my colleagues who don't feel confident in that way.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think...
Now, your course is taught at Cambridge. Is that a counseling department? It's a graduate department of some kind?
It's a small college, and this is a graduate school in that college, at Cambridge College.
But is it psychology or education? What department are you in?
It's
counseling and education.
Yeah, counseling and psychology.
Good, because that's where I teach at SUNY Oswego. Uh-huh. And I've always found the best welcoming that I've gotten in the academic community is in counseling departments, which are usually lodged in the education department. They have a better tradition of being patient-oriented or person-oriented.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was one of my colleagues here at Harvard, actually, is a dean there, and she invited me to teach this course because she knew of my deep interest. So there's certainly an openness there.
How do you find your students responding to a more honest critique of the drugs and the desire to empower them?
To tell you the truth, they're blown away. The course has somewhat of a neutral title, and what I've been told is that they come in and expect to get the usual messages about medications and, you know, probably messages about compliance and things like that. And instead, they get a whole lot of information about side effects and suicidality, agitation, akathisia, all of the, you know, as well as the long-term physical concerns that arise, you know, whether it be diabetes or heart disease or Parkinsonism and so on. So they get all that information, as well as, you know, we do a bit of an overview of neuroanatomy and talk about the particular categories of medications and the different kinds of effects and so on. And they're actually quite shocked, as well as we also talk about the influence of the, you know, Big Pharma and how 50% of the articles, an estimated 50% of articles in on medications are ghostwritten, and you know, and they're shocked. They're actually quite shocked. We cover a lot of ground, and but they've received it in a very appreciative way. I've really been heartened by it's just this question of not having information before, and you know, and I try to approach it in an even-handed way, and let's look at costs and benefits. You know, what are the benefits here? What are the costs here? And the benefits seem to be quite small, and the costs seem to be quite large. And there are real questions about benefits, especially in light of, you know, all the research that's in recent years that's shown placebos to be as effective for the most part as antidepressants, for example. And, you know, and they're shocked to get this information, but in a good way. And I also try to, you know, one of the main efforts is to talk about their role with the clients that they meet with, you know, and indeed, you know, whether they can feel, the question is whether they can feel empowered to talk about side effects, to challenge people to really assume their own power in thinking about what they need. That's sort of at the heart of the course, is to really think about what is your role in meeting with clients when it comes to medications, and you know, and part of it is challenging people and giving them information, and part of it is, you know, being aware yourself of the kinds of effects that might arise from people being on medications and so on. And so, you know, it's an effort to sort of empower them, to empower the clients, and to really question the course that their clients have been set on.
I'm really glad to hear what you're saying. I do think that the future really lies outside of the medical community in terms of improving the delivery of services. And I'm hearing psychologists now and other non-medical psychotherapists, clinical social workers, counselors, marriage and family therapists beginning to think that it's literally unethical to ignore the hazards that their patients endure, their clients endure on psychiatric drugs, and that the proper ethical stance is to join in an honest dialogue about these issues. And it sounds like that's the direction you're in or are moving in, and I'm really glad to hear it. Do you have colleagues in psychology, in the seat of learning of the world, in the Harvard community, who are moving in this direction?
Well, my sense is that people are. It's in my immediate surroundings, and my sense is that people are moving in that direction. But it's a fairly recent shift, and I have to say that in a large part of the system, it doesn't. I don't see that kind of movement yet. I mean, it's interesting. We not long ago, Masha Angel came and spoke at Grand Rounds to the psychiatrist and so on, and they were quite for the listeners. You know, she's the editor, and she's the longtime editor in chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, who wrote the truth about the drug companies.
Yeah, former editor.
Former editor, right?
You got to be former editor to write that book. But go ahead.
yeah, exactly.
Was she received?
Excuse me.
How were they received? Could they be mad at her with all her background? And
no, they actually, you know, she has enough respect and power that they listened. They really listened to her, and they were kind of confused about, like, what does this mean? You know, she was citing some research that raised real questions about medication and raised lots of questions about the studies that have been presented in the past and, you know, that she's so familiar with. And they were open and really kind of questioning what does this mean? What should we do? This is, you know, because it raises real question about a prescriber's role, because, you know, as you know, these days that is what defines their role, is prescribing medications. You know, they don't spend much time talking to people. And so to kind of deny them that role is problematic, because it's like, well, you know, what are we supposed to do here? And that was kind of the question in the air, you know. So they did listen, but on the other hand, you know, I find that sometimes it seems as if people like Masha Angel or people like you, you know, are not speaking. You know, it's as if they're not hearing, and they go back to the old, you know, the old model. So, I you know, I'm seeing shifts in some areas, in some clinical areas, and then in other areas, you know, I'm wondering, it's kind of shocking to me that people haven't seemed to caught up with the information that's really out there.
I don't think it's ever going to happen from within, Frank. As you're talking, I'm thinking about slavery and how abolitionists were considered extremely radical until the Civil War. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that from within the system, which is as dependent on drugs as the South was dependent on slavery, that it's going to ever change from within.
Yeah.
And it's going to change when people say we're not interested anymore on a large scale. And when therapists like yourself, and it will take thousands and thousands of colleagues, decide that they're not going to toe the party line of psychiatry anymore. They're going to do genuine psychological work. It's just not going to come from within. It can't, because if the system viewed things the way I do, there'd be no opportunity for money, power, authority, the few psychiatrists, and there are some of us around the country, and a number of them are on my advisory council, the Empathic Therapy Advisory Council, they have to find alternative ways to make a living, and they can't get rich if they're just doing psychotherapy. Whereas if they were seeing five patients an hour and getting great insurance coverage and putting out the doses and not caring about the consequences, they can do better. So I don't see a change ever coming from within.
Yeah, well, it's really the question of what causes a paradigm change, you know. And it's interesting. I met with a psychiatrist the other day who's outside. He's doing a private practice, and you know, he was he still uses medications to some degree, but he's much more conservative than most prescribers. And he was talking about a group of his fellow psychiatrists in the area that used to get together to talk about sort of all the problems with medications and to, you know, strategize about what to do, I guess. And you know, he's a guy who's sort of turning a corner, I guess. And I think there are those people who are turning a corner. And yet, you know, I mean, it is a question of what is it that causes a paradigm change on a large scale. And I appreciate what you're saying about it not happening within. On the other hand, you know, I'm finding that even as I work within the system to some degree, that I feel my voice is making a difference with my colleagues, for example. And, you know, that in some ways that's where it has to happen, is person to person, and, you know, coming up on particular instances where there's a decision to be made and a challenge being put out there about the usual course of things.
You know, Frank, I got about, 2 minutes at the most before the music starts for our break. But I think that it's any paradigm shift is the wrong model. The notion of a paradigm shift comes out of the idea that science evolves, and as the older scientists die off and the newer scientists come up with the better theories, those theories are adapted scientifically. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that model, and I forget the fellow's name with a K, you know, who
Thomas Kuhn.
Kuhn, whose book, KUHN, sort of developed that concept. I think this is much more like Reagan standing up in Berlin, West Berlin, and saying, "Yeah, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall," and Soviet Union collapsing under its own inability, simply economically, to persist. And I think it's more like slavery and the abolitionists. I don't think that a power group is entrenched over hundreds of years of psychiatry is going to respond to a paradigm shift in the sense that you're talking. And I don't think that there ever has been any science to psychiatry. They claim they've had scientific revolutions, but it's the same old, damaging the brain with one or another approach. Shock, which is still there, widely used, lobotomy occasionally used, drugs, and so on. So I, you know, whether psychology could have a paradigm shift outside of psychiatry, I wonder, because I think that, again, that's one power system. So I'm not as hopeful as you about the paradigm shift, and I don't think it's necessarily the appropriate model. We can pick up on that after the half hour. Mm-hmm. Before we go to break, do you want to tell folks how they can get a hold of you?
Well, I do have a website. It's called whatareyoudoingwithyourlife.com.
That's a great title.
Well, it's the title came from the name of a group that we were running here at Harvard.
Uh-huh. That's great. Well, listen, we got to go to break now. And we'll be back with Frank McNamara in a few minutes. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. And my guest is Dr. Frank McNamara. Frank is a psychologist in the Boston-Cambridge area. He's got a private practice, and he works with students at Harvard University. Frank, during the brief break, did you come up with something you really would like to continue with? Or should I carry us forward?
Oh, please, feel free to carry us forward.
Well, I'd like to hear more about the real experience of being the therapist who's not relying on drugs, not encouraging them, and who's seeing patients who are in that world. Mm-hmm. In my practice, the people who come to see me, they already know my views, because even if they're coming to me cold turkey out of the equivalent of the Yellow Pages, I talk to them on the phone about what I do, so they won't come thinking they're seeing a traditional psychiatrist and feel like, oh, well, I came for drugs. What are you doing? Mm-hmm. So I talk to folks on the phone ahead of time. Can you tell us about Frank's world a little bit?
Frank's world. Okay. I think what is at the heart of Frank's world really is something that you underscore in your work, which is the importance of empathy, the importance of meeting people where they're at and starting there. And it's not just a matter of hearing the words they're saying, but it's a matter of trying to imagine how they're feeling, whether it be anxiety or sadness or, and understanding how they are thinking about the world. And that's the starting point and sort of the continuous thread in the work. It's remarkable, sort of just the power of sharing an experience with a person and reflecting back their experience, and the power of another person articulating his or her experience, which, may be something that they've never really done before. And, I've grown to believe in the power of that and to see how that affects change for people over time. So, that's at the core of it. Piece of it is understanding people in existential terms rather than applying some kind of abstract template onto their experience. I mean, it's understanding their experience as they can describe it. And that's an important piece. I work with, of course, a lot of young people, and it's sometimes understanding things in developmental terms, that it's a tumultuous period in young adulthood where people are coming into their own sense of selves. They're, differentiating their values from the parents or the culture, perhaps, and it's supporting that growth and development. And, I work with students a lot of times in groups, which I find to be very powerful. And we offer groups at Harvard for undergraduates as well as graduate students.
Talk about groups, Frank. We've not had any conversations, I don't think, ever on my radio show about therapy groups. I mean, we've had different kinds of groups, but not therapy groups or groups by generally. So talk a little bit about that and why you think that works well.
Well, I mean, in this particular case, I don't even define it as a therapy group per se. So, for example, I mentioned my website, whatareyoudoingwithyourlife.com.
How do people get into the group? What do they think they're doing?
Well, the group is called What Are You Doing With Your Life? So,
Doesn't sound like a therapy group so much as a personal growth and development.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is actually therapy, but good therapy.
Well, it touches on everything because it touches on, it brings up questions of people's values, what it is that they care about, what is it that motivates them, what is it that they feel discouraged by, what is it that feels enlivening to them. And so it's about life experience, and it's also about understanding influences, you know, things that have influenced your current perception, your current goals, your current values and beliefs. And, you know, when you're talking about that kind of thing, I don't know where you draw the line, really, between that and therapy, you know, because it's really about understanding human experience. And, you know, the hope is that as people, again, as people reflect on their experience, as they share their experience with other people in the group and they hear others' experience, that some clarity emerges. And, you know, maybe there are challenges to long-held beliefs or values that they've internalized. You know, maybe there'll be new ways of thinking about their lives and options and so on. And that can be very powerful, as well as, you know, it's interesting at a place like Harvard because there are so many competent people walking around as if they're, you know, they have it all together. And in fact, you know, underneath there might be a lot that they're dealing with. And you bring people into a group and suddenly you can have an honest conversation, you know, with your peers. And that can be powerful to feel like, you know, oh, you know, other people have this kind of experience. Other people are unhappy with the course of their lives or where they're going. And, you know, and you get to step back and reflect on.
How often do you get together with this kind of a group?
Once a week, typically.
And does it stay fairly steady or a lot of people come and go?
It stays quite steady. Usually we offer it for one semester and people more often than not continue on into the for the rest of the year.
That could be the most important education experience of at Harvard for some of them, I'm sure.
Well, I have to say, yeah. You know, the idea behind offering this kind of thing was that people are studying a lot of abstract academic things. And where are they really reflecting on their own experience, their own values, what they care about, what motivates them? And, you know, it doesn't happen in a lot of places these days, so we wanted to offer a place where they could really do that. And I think it is fundamental to an educational mission. It should be fundamental to an educational mission.
I find this very, very interesting and worthwhile. How would the students hear about you?
We're connected with the university, you know, and so there are listservs that go out advertising our groups and mm-hmm. you know, and there's been postering around campus and so on. And so or else it might come just, you know, from referrals within. But a lot of people, you know, just see the group advertised somewhere and they contact us and, you know, and then we meet with them and bring them into the group. It's one of, you know, professionally speaking, it's one of the most rewarding experiences for me. I really love doing these kinds of groups. They're very, very meaningful. Because the conversation is so honest, you know, you break through the veneer, you get, you know, you get to have some very meaningful, honest conversations with people, and that's very powerful.
You know? Do these groups often get into what we would consider the therapeutic issues, like, well, when I was a kid, or is it pretty much stay away from that?
No, I mean, we don't stay away from anything. I mean, they don't automatically go there all the time because. I mean, it might be touched on, but, you know, the focus isn't going back in time because the assumption is that whatever influenced you back then, you carry with you today, you know, and it's important to the extent that it is carried with you today. So, you know, someone might touch on some experience from the past, but really the meaning is in how it touches their lives today and how they continue to be influenced by those.
Do you tend in your private practice to have a more contemporary issues-oriented therapy, or do you do a lot of work on childhood?
I don't My primary interest is here and now and what's going on with the individual. I think the past can be important at times. It can certainly, there are certainly, pivotal experiences that need to, need to be explored. But the primary focus is on the here and now because, as I was saying, I think the importance, the significance of the early experiences is how it is influencing persons' perceptions and beliefs and feelings today, how it's affecting their relationships today. And so, my assumption is that if you focus on here and now today, then that's the most direct route to understanding someone's experience. But it certainly doesn't, I certainly wouldn't, I don't veer away from talking about the past, but, my primary focus is on here and now.
It sounds like you enjoyed working with people in your groups and individually.
Yeah, I do.
No burnout after all these years?
No burnout at all. No, absolutely not. I almost don't understand the concept. When I hear, sometimes you see these workshops offered for clinicians on burnout, and it's like, I don't understand it.
Well, this is interesting. I wouldn't mind spending a little time talking about it. I haven't talked much about it here, but I've actually got a book chapter coming out on it and on burnout, and I talk a little bit about it sometimes in workshops. But I think if you're non-coercive and you respect the autonomy of your clients or patients and you're not coercive and you really enjoy their feelings and don't suppress them with drugs, I think you end up that being a therapist is just a blessing. It's a privilege. It's an honor.
Yeah.
And, I don't feel any burnout, and I've been doing this since 1954 when I started working with the worst of the worst patients, the state mental hospital back ward patients.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was a Harvard student in 54, working on as a volunteer. And I've never had burnout. Either. And I do think it's because we both share a non-coercive, caring attitude. It would be like burning out on friendship for me.
Yeah, exactly. And you might be putting your finger on the difference, because maybe it is that coercive element, and it's not to say that things aren't challenging at times, especially, working with I'm thinking again of medication and sometimes trying to help people get off of medications, and that can be, as you know better than anyone, that can be a challenging process and
can be terrifying.
Terrifying, yeah.
It's very hard work, yes.
It is, and so it can be nail biting in a sense, but it's still not about burnout. Maybe I've been fortunate in getting through those crises and, getting to stable ground and then seeing the rewards of doing that. And ultimately it is rewarding. And, like you said, I feel it's a privilege to do this work, to sit down with another individual and to have them trust you in a way where they can share their most personal thoughts and feelings. That's quite an honor, really, to be in that position.
I really like sharing this viewpoint. Most of the folks I have on the show are doing a lot of more public things, and I don't often just talk with somebody who spends his time helping folks just doing a lot of more public things. Do you think that as you're getting more interested in these issues that you'll start to speak in public about them? Do you think you want to get involved in that kind of thing, or are you going to be very happily content not to make yourself crazy.
Well, you know, this brings to mind the conversation we're having a little bit, just a little while ago about, you know, how things change. And I must say that, you know, you can look at large systemic change, and I think, you know, there are people doing, like yourself, who are doing incredibly important things in that public way. And then there's a kind of quieter change on a, you know, an individual level, you know, with one person at a time. And I think a lot of times that level of change is undervalued, you know, that really if you're being in the world in a different way, then you're changing the world in a sense, you know, and you're influencing other people who then influence other people. And so I think there is a ripple effect. And so, you know, if I were to become more public, then fine. I could see embracing an aspect of that. On the other hand, I really value just, you know, meeting one person at a time and having a heart-to-heart with that individual, and it might not be sharing personal. It might be challenging people, or raising different perspectives and engaging in some kind of conflicted dynamic, even. But you know, I value that, operating on that level, one person engaging another person. And, you know, over the years, it's interesting. I feel like the number of people multiply, of course, and so.
Right. Talk some, Frank, about the kind of changes you see in people. You know, on psychiatric drugs, you see no really life-changing improvements. You see, at best, a holding still of a person often loses interest in their lives. Can you just briefly, without getting into too much personal details of therapists, talk about the kind of change that real therapists see in their patients?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, that's a great, great question. What I see over time is I see a fundamental shift in people's values and their attitudes towards the world. So, for example, somebody might, I'm thinking of a graduate student who's been very, very anxious about her work, and her, you know, her whole sense of self was very wrapped up in her work so much that she was kind of paralyzed and having difficulty moving ahead. And of course, you know, you could well imagine that somebody could easily find their way into an office where they would end up on medication to help them relax and so on. But, you know, this person worked with me, and over time, she got to a place where she was able to relax and let go of the anxiety. You know, her whole sense of self wasn't invested in her performance, and she's been able to move ahead in a way where she has a different relationship with the world, you know, because she's more relaxed. She's trying to control fewer things in her life, you know, instead being more accepting. Still working hard, you know, still engaging her work in probably a more meaningful way. I mean, that's just a small example. I feel like there are a lot of people who experience that level of change where, there's another graduate student who, same kind of process that she went through, and her thing had to do more with, a particular kind of interpersonal orientation that kind of denied her own self in favor of kind of being there for other people. And that shifted over time. And as it did, you know, she was, again, able to relax and feel more connected with other people because she was being more herself and putting herself more forward. And there are lots of things like that. And they found, that, you know, it might not sound meaningful as I talk about it, but it really changes a person's whole experience of the world. You know, there's a fundamental shift that happens sometimes that seems to be small, but it has a huge effect. And, you know, there's that level of change. And then, you know, there's another level of change where, you know, that can be very dramatic. For example, working with somebody who is on medication and helping them get off medication and then becoming what seems to be a totally different person, you know. And I had that a very dramatic example of that happen recently with a person who really had kind of lost all energy for life. You know, she was on multiple medications and was sort of in the psychiatric system, just being treated, going to day programs and so on. And we got her off of this medication with the help of a prescriber, and she has blossomed into a totally different being. She is engaged. She's gone back to school. She's getting all A's in her courses. The lights are on again. It's a dramatic change.
That's really lovely. Do you work with couples and families? I think some of my most satisfying work to this day is helping couples who love each other actually get to enjoy that love and build more creative and happier lives and leave behind anger and misery. And that, of course, influences the children and spreads to other families.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite things to do. Do you get the opportunity to work with couples and families?
I don't do much of that work. I don't work with families. Occasionally, I'll see couples for a bit, and that can be satisfying work. But it's not my that's not what I usually do.
Well, I think one of the things that people really need to realize is how different therapists are. I mean,
yeah.
Frank and I, you and I have a lot of similar views, but I do one thing that you don't do much of, and I've never been comfortable doing groups. So,
oh, really?
never been comfortable. I think I might enjoy your kind of a group, but every time I get into groups, I run into just not knowing how to relate intimately to 12 people or 5 people, and then jealousies develop and conflicts, and I just never got to be good at it. I really like the intensiveness of being with just with a family or an individual. So therapists differ so much, and it's so important for the public, the consumer, to realize this. Because one of the really terrible things people hear from therapists is, quote, you know, therapy is not helping you. I think you need medications. They don't even say, my therapy isn't helping you, or my kind of therapy isn't helping you, or what I do in here doesn't need to help you. They say, therapy, as if they had the in on the one thing
isn't helping you.
And we all do such different things. No therapist should ever look a patient in the eye or a client in the eye and say, I'm not helping you, so you need drugs. It just doesn't follow.
Right, that's a good point.
It sounds like we're coming to our wonderful conclusion. My guest, Frank McNamara, psychologist. You can find him in Boston, Cambridge. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Peter. It's been a great honor to talk with you.